Welcome, friends. This is Red Ice Creations Radio. I am your host, Henrik Palmgren, and if you're curious to know, we are based in Sweden on the West Coast. This is Internet Talk Radio, and we have a new show for you every Thursday and Sunday. Thanks to Duncan O'Finnian for being with us last Thursday, talking about his experiences and memories as a former super soldier. If you're interested, you can always click your way to our radio archive on redicecreations.com and tune in to any of our past shows. But that you will have to do later, because I know you're here to listen to our very latest program with Michael Tesarion, and we do have a jam-packed show for you, so let's get right to it. All right, here we are, folks, right in the middle of February 2007, and a warm welcome back, folks. We are grateful to spend some time again with our regular monthly guest, Michael Tesarion, who is on with us on the line. At this point, I hope you're familiar with the show and with Michael Tesarion, but if you are new, I highly recommend that you check out our archived shows with Michael, at least the last two shows, as we are going to continue on our theme of our two latest shows and talk about the children and the outsider today. And I know that Michael also wanted to bring up a few other points right away here, so I think we just should dive right into it, getting to some current stuff and so forth here. So welcome back to the show, Michael. It's great to have you here.
Yes, Henrik, thank you. Nice to be back.
Awesome. You know, you mentioned in the mail to me regarding the Paul Levy show. I guess you had taken the time to listen to it.
Yeah, I did. I was waiting for that show. It's been a long time that wanted to get him on the show, and for people just to hear from another point of view this kind of approach that I've been talking about leading up to 2012. You know, about facing the shadow and the kind of catharsis and the kind of realization as to why the leaders, you know, that we, the kind of the political leaders, how they come to power. People have, especially in America, got to be much more familiar with some of the psychodynamics involved in all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, some of the psychological implications as opposed to just the political implications. You know,
yeah.
Like I've been saying, we leave consciousness at the door, you know, and even psychiatry, you know, is leaving consciousness at the door, which is unbelievable, you know. But this is then, hopefully we'll talk about a little bit later about the state of the children in the world, you know,
yeah.
And how they're being understood right now, or lack of understanding. But yeah, Paul's approach, you know, is very good in the sense that he emphasized the fact that the consensus trance, I mean, if people listen to the interview he did with you, they'll see that he was saying that, first of all, I think was very striking, is that the consensus trance is so strong and so powerful that most people don't even know they're in it.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, this is a key part of what he was saying.
Yeah.
This sort of immersion into the collective where they don't even realize they're insane. In fact, so many people tell me, you know, when they're at work, and then they maybe just, you know, incidentally, or maybe they full-blown bring up conversations about politics or the way things are happening in the world.
Mm.
And most of their workmates look at them as if they're totally crazy.
Yeah,
even if they're talking about fluoride, you know, or the fluorescent lights, or any kind of, you know, political situation, or Big Brother, or why do we have to sign endless documents? What's all of this invasion into our privacy? And, you know. And suddenly the whole work will just look at them as if, oh my God, you're really paranoid, you're really crazy. When in fact they are the ones who are crazy, you know, these are the ones subscribing to such a demonic type of interference into their personal lives. But the incredible thing, you know, that Paul is bringing out and what psychoanalytically aware people know is that you are ostracized, you are made into a nut, even if you're not an outsider. Even if in every other way you pretty much go along to get along. But should you even voice, you know, problems with any area of what people accept, you are looked at as if you're kind of, you know, off the wall, or sort of, you know, paranoid or delusional in some way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The art of, you know, self-observation using, you know, common logic and just being aware of stuff. I mean, that seems to be enough these days to get in the position of being the paranoid, I guess.
That's right. And, of course, you know, Jung and others have always said that the observation, you know, I don't know, is R.D. Lang or somebody like that said that, you know, it's very, very difficult for people to observe themselves.
Mm.
This is a key problem, and it's also one of the, you know, problems of the outsider.
Yeah.
that, you know, I mean, Alan Watts, this is not the modern day Alan Watt, but the great Zen teacher Alan Watts, you know, he said that nothing so eludes conscious inspection as consciousness itself.
Hmm.
This is why the root of consciousness has been called the unconscious. I mean, it's just the semantics in one way, but we can understand it in another way. He's perfectly right. People do not want to spend the energy to look inside, and even with those who begin to do that, you know, there's a lot of people I deal with who are coming to my work, and then they see this, and then they do it, and they have these questions, and after they've done it, they observe aspects of the mind, and the first things that they notice is that it's very hard to observe it.
Yeah, yeah.
It takes a tremendous, and it's invisible. It's like an unstill mirror that is constantly moving.
Yeah.
Because and then some very astute people get back to me on the blog, or, you know, they've been doing this work for a while, and then they say that, look, it's almost like the ego is playing with itself, because is it really myself that's observing, or is the ego observing itself? You know, and I had a conversation with one gentleman over this, and I'm sure Paul Levy and others have very similar sort of, you know, conversations, and that is that, look, the ego is very, very clever. When it finally finds out, you know, or suspects that you want to leave, that you want to end this fiasco, and you want to move back into selfhood, meaning you want to step out of these roles and out of these Frankensteinian boots, you know, and this sort of straitjackets of roles, sister, daughter, brother, lover, mother, you know, uncle, nephew, workmate, you know, all the roles. When you want to get out of those, the ego is very clever, and it sort of simulates a center. In other words, it sort of manufactures a center that is almost a mirror image or an analog of the self. Yeah, because as we said, the ego is an idea of yourself. The self is yourself.
Yeah.
But the ego is a chameleon. The ego is the magician in the tarot card, you know, the number one. He's the juggler. And one of the interesting things that the ego can do is it, just like a camouflage, like one of those butterflies or one of those chameleons, it can actually take on the form of the self. It can actually delude you fully. And it can create, since we know that the self is very strong and that the self is, you know, ancestral and has a deep wisdom and is very secure, well, the ego sort of manufactures a hardened center that can almost mimic. So you're trying to put the key in the door, and you might actually, you know, be waylaid into believing, you know, like the fool's gold version. So people who move on this journey towards the self often get waylaid in that kind of cul-de-sac, and the gurus are also sort of responsible for a lot of that. Those gurus, I believe, are waylaid themselves along the way. You know, because the ego provides them lots of power, lots of cities, a lot of magical, you know, abilities, a lot of certain charisma. You see, and then people can think that's God, that's reality. It happens. So yeah, there is a very great difficulty, you know, in observing the self.
Yeah.
But he also brought up, you know, one thing Paul also brought up was very interesting. Is this? I noticed that he said that, you know, basically, human beings, you know, right now we're getting another lesson. We're getting another opportunity to see that our identification with these leaders, basically, we're buying in to the delusion. You know, we are part and party of it. We just can't keep pointing the finger and saying, oh, look, get rid of that politician, you know, because one of these guys, you know, is replaced by another one, equally as bad.
So exactly.
The dynamic is now to turn to a psychological understanding of that we are complicit. You know, he made this very clear, that we are complicit in this.
Yeah.
Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, you know, brings that out again. And what are we really identifying with? We're not, you know, there's George Bush. Yeah, but we don't know George Bush. We're identifying with the president.
Yeah.
That's a role. That's not, the man is unimportant.
Exactly.
Because that man, like Paul was saying, you know, Henrik, is lost himself within the delirium, within the dilemma. Remember Paul was saying something about how they become possessed almost by the archetype, the negative archetype?
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's it. Their ego is lost in a negative way. Their ego dissolves, but it's in a negative way. It dissolves into the greater archetypal matrix, this vortex of power hungriness, you know, the wrath of Khan, you know, it's all the demagogues, all the heroes, all the maniacs are lost in this power dynamic. They've lost love. They've lost any kind of humanity, because now they become disciples of power.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing there is the president, the governor, the police chief, the mayor. You know, that's just like mother and father and teacher. You know, it's all the roles.
Yeah, sure.
So we do it in our local family unit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a, you know, a creation of psychopathy. Of course, you know, some people have less psychopathy and some have more. So if you have less, then you consider yourself normal or adjusted.
I mean,
but you're not adjusted. It's just that your psychopathy in the family is slightly less than, you know, the guy next door. So you can con yourself into believing that you've got it all made and everything's happy.
Yeah.
You can, you know, you watch advertisements on TV that show you the perfect glowing, you know, Folgers coffee family.
Sure. Yeah.
And if you come anywhere close to looking like that, then you've made it. You know, if you've made it in the Hollywood way,
exactly.
What the media is showing you, then you're adjusted.
Yeah. It's a feedback loop in a way, and also, of course, the image of these persons up there. I mean, it's choreographed, it's scripted to the minute details, and I mean, one thing that seems to be very difficult for people to get through is that is the image of the man, as you say, not the man itself or the woman itself that we're looking at. I mean, people are you know, weirded out if you say that, you know, George Bush hangs out at Skull and Bones or whatever, but I mean, we don't know anything about the person George Bush, just about the,
as you say,
the president. I mean,
he doesn't know anything about himself.
Yeah.
He has lost his health. He has become, you know, a disciple of power.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not a human being. He's a human in form. But, you know, you can make an android that looks like human. You know, you go to Madame Tussauds in London, there's plenty of you know, waxworks there.
Sure.
They look pretty human. But the thing is that the humanity is gone. The virtue has completely disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that individual. And, yeah, they... And, see, don't forget that these individuals, no matter if it's George Bush or Margaret Thatcher, you know, Adolf Hitler, whoever, they have the perfect right to do what they're doing. It's an extension of what Paul was saying when he says to his friends, don't, you know, just climb into your hermitage and try to escape from the world, be also part of the world, realize that you have a role here.
Yeah,
that was also something he brought out, and an extension to that is that, look, these people have the perfect right. You have no right to go around politically telling them that they can't do what they have to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
He said that you're feeding the fire if you go and try to, you know, say, I'm against that person.
Yeah.
Your againstness is still a form of energy, one that is very, very useful to the beast and to the ego.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
so
right.
So what we have to understand is that these people are human, you know, the human part of them, the decision-making faculty in them, their background, you know, like in the Alan Rousseau interview with Alex Jones, you know, he brings this up, that, look, these people basically, you know, have made a series of choices, and they have the right to make those choices. You make your choices, and your choices are meant to be healthy and human and virtuous. That's your right. But you waving a placard or beating them over the head, you know, it's like this song by Rush, you know, they have one of the songs on Power Windows about this. You have no right to enforce them to say, be different.
Hmm.
You know,
yeah.
They take a right to tell you what to do, you know, with cameras in the airport and sign here and all the sorts of things that they make you go through as a business person or as an individual.
Hmm.
But that's the very thing you don't want to do. You don't want to become like them in their place by dictating to them if they cannot be.
Yeah, sure.
What you got to do is take care of your own garden. And, you know, that is, you cannot vote out evil.
Yeah.
Evil wants to make you think you can vote it out. You can't. If you waste your energy that way, it's meaningless.
Yeah.
You know, Jung said something incredible.
Yeah.
He said, we have lost our superstitious fear of evil spirits and things that go bump in the night. But instead, we are seized with terror of people who, possessed by demons, perpetrate the frightful deeds of darkness. That the doers of such deeds think of themselves not as possessed, but as supermen, quote-unquote, does not alter the fact that they are possessed or of their possession.
Hmm.
So he's saying that, look, yeah, we don't fear the goblins, you know, and the trolls.
Hmm.
Back in Sweden, right, everybody's scared of the trolls. You know, although they know the troll is also a positive energy. But in every culture, you've got the bogeyman, you know.
Yeah.
But see, those fears in modern man, he says, is pretty much gone. You're living in these artificial cities. You don't see those witches on broomsticks, you know, the goblins or the elves or any of this stuff.
Mm.
But you got worse. You've got possessed human beings who are possessed by demonic energy, by sorcery, you know, and they go around doing the things. And one of their biggest agendas is to make you identify with that power just as they have identified with it.
Mm.
And if you're weak enough and you're impotent enough and you're totally, you know, slowly been programmed by the television and everything else to completely be in fear, then of course you're more likely, as we've said in other shows, to do that. You know.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. You know, you mentioned the recent Aaron Roos interview with Alex Jones. Did you see this entire interview?
Yeah, I wanted to mention that because I have it on my blog for those who've never seen it. This is a recent interview that Alex Jones did with Alan Rousseau, you know, from Freedom to Fascism.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's a very good interview for many reasons. One of the reasons is because in that interview, he basically talks about his first-hand experience when he's talking to one of the Rockefellers, and he senses the cold, indifferent nature of the Rockefeller. So if people go to my blog, to the War on You section, watch that interview and pay special attention to that. That when he's describing how cold and indifferent and completely inhuman, you know, this character that was talking to him about the human race and why they do the things to the human race. Notice what Aaron Rousseau is saying, because Rousseau himself doesn't realize, because he's probably not familiar with, you know, my work on the alien side of things, but, you know, people who make the connection can see a very interesting anecdote there. So if they go there, they can see that that incredible interview.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a couple of other things on that area of the blog. I think there's one where I show the connections. Remember we were talking earlier about Bono?
Sure, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And I wanted to make, you know, back up what I was saying. And if they go to the blog, they'll see a link that actually talks about Bono and U2 and their Swiss financial connections.
Oh, really?
How they moved from Island Records and how there's a lot of funny big breaks, you know. Because remember, as I was telling you, when the controllers of the Dionysian cult and some of these cults are operating through these people's champions, they auto-promote those people. They promote those people over the heads of others.
Yeah, sure.
They do it very subtly so that you won't find out about it, so that you blink your eyes and then tomorrow these guys are big stars or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's a very good link there to show you how it was done in the case of U2, that these people, you know, had their company was ruined, but then they were given big shares in it, and then suddenly they were bought out by the Swiss, right, connection, the Vatican Masonic connection, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Very similar story to those who know about the Rolling Stones and so on. So again, you know, interesting to see that right in the middle of the media today, these people's champions, they don't just get there by accident because they're just great old souls, you know.
Excellent. Yeah, I got to check that out. That's very interesting. And as you say, this happens time and time again when you research many of these big groups. So, and
I update that section of the blog. In fact, I update the blog, you know, frequently, so people need to go back there. There's also on the same War on You section some interesting stuff on mind control.
How about
the leaders of the world, the military leaders, and also the presidents being mind controlled. There's some interesting information there. People need to get their arms around much of this information. They should come back to my blog, you know, on a daily basis, or to the websites, or to your own Red Ice website, because, you know, we need to be updated daily on this.
Yeah.
Stop turning to the normal media to, you know, tune into all the lies and the mind control.
Yeah.
And get savvy with a lot of the stuff, you know, because you may not be into one area of what I'm doing, but, you know, I do a lot of different things. So people
Absolutely.
Who, you know, maybe go, oh, I don't buy into this stuff over here, you know, well, yeah, we got a lot of stuff. You know, we got a whole palette of things that you might be interested in.
Exactly. And also, of course, you sent me that link. Thank you very much. I put it up there. I'm talking about the Brotherhood of the Bell, the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's another one. I'm glad you reminded me.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff I was talking about is, so I recommend people to go to the symbolism section and the War on You section are two primary sections of the blog. And on the War on You section, I also put up, I believe, the Brotherhood of the Bell. It wasn't actually me that put it up. It was one of my distributors, A.J. Bruno from One Heart Books.
Sure.
He's an official distributor.
Yeah.
He found it on YouTube. So if they go to the link on my blog and click on Brotherhood of the Bell, you'll actually have the privilege of watching an extremely rare movie that is a big-time whistleblowing movie, which is very, very hard to find. You know, most people who have this video only have a really, you know, old VHS copy. So somebody has put it up on the web, so while it's still there, everyone who's listening to this should go to, you know, check out the Brotherhood of the Bell with Glenn Ford and check out this remarkable movie that's also late. I also put out the note there that this movie is also laced with a numerological symbolism under the main theme of the movie. There's a whole maritime theme running there about the, you know, maritime law.
Yeah.
And the mentioning of the you know, this whole connection to the high seas, even in the decor, they use it.
And
then also the concept of numerology that runs all the way through the film. So again, a great study. I used to show that movie when I did my classes in America, when I did classes on the tarot and on astrology. Sometimes we'd, you know, take an hour, and then I'd show a particular movie or documentary as well if we had time, and that was one I used to show to my class members, and everybody really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's very, very eerie and very, very scary in one way.
But very well done, actually. I think the acting is stupendous in that film, and I really, really love the movie just for its acting.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's
and just
it's
the
great.
Brilliant themes, because, of course, the tarot numerological themes is that he's the fool. You know, they mentioned the number 22 in the movie, and the key character is really kind of like a fool character.
Mm-hmm,
who's himself gone through a period of initiation. where his life turns upside down. He goes into the underworld and he comes back out, you know, sort of renewed.
Yeah.
There's some tremendous tarot numerological symbolism and alchemy, a lot of alchemical symbolism in this film.
Yeah, yeah. I think, by the way, just to throw that in, I think it was you who recommended Being There with... I forget his name now, but
Peter
Sellers.
Peter Sellers.
Yeah, same theme kind of running through there. Awesome movie.
That's an extremely esoteric film.
Yeah,
that's an extremely esoteric film. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
and I've always loved it, and I think it's very funny. I mean, it's a hilarious movie. It's also one of Peter Sellers. It was Peter Sellers' last film.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a novel film. It's also a whistleblowing movie.
Yeah.
The multimillionaire, billionaire in that is, you know, meant to be one of the Rothschilds or one of the Astors. They kind of paint him in a way. You can definitely tell he's one of these major Illuminati, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
East Coast billionaires like J.P. Morgan or Lord Astor or, you know, even Piers Morgan, you know.
Yeah.
So they're dropping a lot of hints in that film, too.
Certainly.
An excellent film. But the esoteric aspects coming out of the old Gnostic, you know, canon, out of the early books of the Bible, is also very, very finely done.
Yeah.
Extremely brilliant film.
Absolutely, I totally agree. All right, let's dive into the main theme today. Well, I think we're halfway through the program already, so it's time to go there. Regarding the children and the outsider, of course. And let me begin here with this quote, Michael. David Kaiser, a practicing psychiatrist in Chicago, states, "Modern psychiatry has yet to convincingly prove the genetic, biologic cause of any single mental illness."
Right, absolutely. And, you know, that basically, that's a good quote, because, you see, there's a big push on now. Basically, you know, to be brief about it, the problem with the children is not so much their behavior, but the way that the experts, or the so-called system, is slowly, 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 over a period of about 25 years now, been trying to very subtly redefine children and their behavior as a sort of a disorder. So that quote that you read is very important, because, you know, other experts are saying, wait a minute, there is no evidence that the kind of weird behavior or dysfunctional behavior or, you know, emotionally moody behavior of children has anything to do with, you know, a mental disorder or any kind of biological, you know, disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the last 25 years now, children are being repackaged, basically. And this is going to affect the parents, because every new parent, you know, who starts to read what the system is saying about children is going to probably believe all this rubbish.
Yeah.
So it's very important to realize that it's not the behavior of children that is the problem. It's the slow reinvention of how to diagnose children, and this is what teachers are being taught, because it's extremely important right now for the system to make it seem that your child or any child in general is basically has mental disorders.
Yeah.
And the reason why they want this to happen is because if you buy into it, and you are buying into it because the media, the FDA commercials, these fake articles that appear on the web and also in the newspapers about these findings, if you believe any of this stuff, then you are going to sanction Big Brother, the AMA, the FDA, to fix your child through drugs.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. Some children have a lot of problems, you know, leading up even to sort of what might be called schizophrenia or multiple personality, whatever, right? But see, those can be treated in purely homeopathic, healthy, you know, proper psychoanalytical means.
Yeah.
So we're talking, you know, so if you in fact do have a problem child or a malady, please understand that we're, you know, okay, granted. But there are many, many healthy ways to deal with that. But we must understand that society itself, the system, my big worry is that the system, the teachers, the schools, the institutions, the TV, the media, is reinventing a way to look at children as if children are a disorder. Right? Children themselves. Thing called a child is basically a problem.
Yeah.
That needs to be controlled. Just another way you brand chickens or you brand, you know, pigs or something. A child, when it's born, is basically a problem. It's a problem to the parent. He's a problem to the neighbors. He's a problem to the system. He's a problem to the school. You know, and look at the trench coat mafia. You know, is your kid the one who's going to bring a gun to school and kill everybody? Is your kid showing signs of, you know, craziness? Is your kid's, you know, getting into, you know, Nazi websites? Or is your kid, you know, being seduced on the web? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, certainly.
You know, is your kid eating the right stuff? Is your kid hanging out with the right people? You know, in other words, your kid is a completely brainless, idiotic twat who left alone for 5 seconds without your, you know, control, basically, is going to run amok into all kinds of evil. This is what the system wants to show that children are, so that they completely erase the normal, you know, true organic understanding of what a child is.
Yeah.
And once the human beings, the parents, start to basically embody this, that then becomes the projected scenario onto the child, who then does go and act in those ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like the loop you just talked about, this feedback loop. What's been happening over the last 25 years is that people have been noticing there's tremendous negative changes in the behavior of children. My take on this,
mm-hmm.
I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it, is
mm-hmm.
that behavioral change is a result. It is a symptom of wrong thinking about children.
Hmm.
You know, connecting also to the loss of innocence of adults,
mm-hmm.
for a start.
Yeah, yeah.
But secondly, the buying into a very, very negative opinion about children that, you know, has got to go. And we always talked in previous shows about how man's idea of himself is erroneous. It's just an idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, Paul Levy backing this up, that, you know, the ideas we have about ourselves are ego-generated. They're not real. But my goodness, then, you know, the first, one of the key relationships we have is with the children.
Yeah,
and they are reacting negatively, not to our, not to the parents. So any parent who's listening to this, please understand, they're not reacting to you. They're reacting to the negative ideas you have about them. This is where the problem is. It's a problem of fundamental communication, which children are reacting against the negative ideas that are projected upon them. And they find that going to video games, you see, or playing out these roles, or sort of Dungeons and Dragons, and all sorts of heroic things that they turn to, those heroes, those games, treat them better. Those games present them with a better image.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at those games and go, they're very violent video games. Yeah, but your kid's the hero in those games.
Yeah, sure.
Exactly. Is he the hero at home or is he just a slave? When a child is born, right, he is the weakest individual in that family. And the family continues to remind him that all the way through his teenage years.
Yeah.
That you are weaker by musculature, you're weaker mentally, you're weaker emotionally all the way through. You are the weakest, you know, party in this dynamic. They don't say that, but that is basically the fact.
Exactly.
The child is often not empowered.
Yeah.
So there are turns to anything, video games, you know, virtual reality, the sports, to, you know, driving sports cars, you know, or doing anything that brings out the adrenaline and makes that person feel of self-worth.
Sure, yeah.
And it will even join a gang. It will kill. It will commit crime. It will do all sorts of things in order to feel the self-worth, the sense of heroism, you see, that is denied.
Hmm. So this is the also, of course, that we can tie in, as you say, the medication in this. This is the basically the Ritalin generation, and where ADHD is popping up, you know, as a symptom everywhere. And
that's right.
And again,
and this is that thing I was talking about, that they're trying to make it look like any type of dysfunctional behavior is a disorder, literally a mental disorder. They even talk now, they've literally diagnosed children who have a little bit of problem in school, you're instantly diagnosed now as what's called oppositional defiant disorder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Look how ludicrous. Oppositional defiant disorder. What it really means is your kid's a rebel.
So he's odd, right?
The he's short, odd, yeah. He hates the system. He sees we're full of trash. We're totally idiotic.
Mm.
We're like, you know, we're pathetic victims of the system.
Yeah.
He doesn't buy in, so he's immediately oppositional, defiant, and disorderly.
Amazing.
Now, you know, does that mean that the children is a child, that child is something, somebody you're going to learn from, that is a teacher in his own right, that has got a point, or maybe, in fact, has an incredible understanding? No, this is some gulag, you know, victim.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you used to see in 1984, they're going to put you in chains and send you to one of these penal colonies as some sort of, you know, retarded rebel. This is, we're on the verge of this again.
Absolutely.
In which anyone who shows the slightest form of non-conformity is going to be tied down, strapped down, you know, and injected.
Yeah.
And totally ostracized.
Sure. And I mean, you have the mental health screening laws in England, and tying this together with antisocial behavior and this kind of stuff. All
right.
Of this ties together, and it seems like, you know, they're narrowing the perspective right now on what is considered to be, in quotes here, normal.
Right.
So, I mean, it's amazing.
Well, you know, psychiatry, the APA, that's the American Psychiatric Association, these people have always hated Freud from day one because he hated them.
Mm.
When Freud came over to America, he hated the whole situation, and he saw that they were going nowhere with his work. So he left, and he basically wrote off the West. He wrote off America. So in response, they turned to B.F. Skinner, you see, and to the behaviorist pattern, and they basically threw consciousness out.
Yep.
When you look at the whole of American psychiatry, which is now basically just a monopoly for drug peddling, That is what they did. They left consciousness out. You just fix the machine. You know, Alfred Hitchcock, any type of time when psychoanalysis, even through the movies, like Alfred Hitchcock made several movies, like Vertigo, which is one of my favorite films, but he also made other ones like Spellbound. Every single one, that's about 3 to 4 movies he made that, you know, featured very prominently psychoanalysis. In fact, one of the movies is actually dedicated to the school of psychoanalysis. If you compare of 100 movies he made, the 3 or 4 that he made from about psychoanalysis or that involved psychoanalysis were the least watched, least liked, and most confusing films.
Okay.
Except one, which was Frenzy, and that's because, you know, he made it so differently, and it had other things that drew attention to the movie, like the violence and the way it was made. So accepting Frenzy, accepting Psycho, I'm thinking of Psycho, not Frenzy.
Okay, yeah, sure, okay.
But, you know, because that was made differently and it had a different kind of drama that attracted people, but he put a lot of publicity into that. But despite that film, every other one that he tried to get psychoanalysis on the map and, you know, into the American psyche, it failed. And the reason why is not just the APA, but it is Hollywood itself trashing in the movies psychoanalysis. So that every time that you see somebody being psychoanalyzed, they call him the shrink.
Yeah.
You know, Hollywood was down, down, down. When Montgomery Clift, the actor, tried to go and get psychoanalysis, so many people put him off. The whole movement, it was like taboo. And anybody that kind of did that was an idiot. And the shrinks themselves, they said that the psychologist was a shrink, you know, basically a malingering, you know, a charlatan. This is basically what went on for 25, 30 years that in America that these people were charlatans. So, you know, people were down on it. And you only could go to one if you were very, you know, rich.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seemed like an exploitative kind of thing, you know, so the whole concept was very downed.
Interesting.
But, you know, the kids are now being, it's like Aldous Huxley, he said it about the programming. He said, sensual pleasures programmed into people as infants through hypnopedic messages repeated thousands of times as they slept. These messages encouraged sexual promiscuity, attendance at mass entertainments, and the ingestion of drugs for any and every unpleasant feeling or little bit of distress. It's Aldous Huxley talking about the future of the mind-controlled world. And it is actually, we're seeing this.
Yeah. Amazing. How about, you know, Woody Allen also always had this kind of shrink theme going on, too. I mean, do you want to comment on that?
I think it's kind of, this is a little bit different because I think he tried to have it intelligently. You know, and at least he shows the pros and cons of it. At least he brings up the subject of psychoanalysis to show you the both sides of it.
Yeah.
You know, but it is a way. He basically shows you that you have to match going to a therapist, you know, with your own investigation of yourself. Which is what his characters basically always do. And that's a very humorous, you know, and also a very you know, baneful thing. His movies always show you characters who are going through a sort of a self-analysis.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting thing to do, you know. And people need to get back to it because we have to understand, as I keep emphasizing, that's the only thing that's going to save us, you know. I mean, the Bible talks about it. You have, do you remember that Paul was talking about the diabolic? Remember he was talking about the diabolical is a word in etymology that means to divide?
Sure, absolutely.
And that the symbolical means to bring together? You know, there's a very brilliant analysis there that symbol literacy is very important. Also, in the Bible, you know, they have a word for repent. The word repent, that you keep hearing Jesus saying repent, or, you know, the Christians believe in repent. Well, that was a bad translation of a word called metanoia. This is a Greek word called metanoia. And metanoia actually really represented the psychoanalytical analysis of yourself and the repentance for the way that you've been. Not just deeds that you've done to others. It means much more than just giving up, you know, your sinful habits. It talks about a deep transformation. The word metanoia meant a transformation of the basic structure of one's life. And that only happens when you return to virtue and you have a deep sense of, you know, introspective analysis of who you are. This is the true meaning of the Christian word repent. You know, in the Gospel of Thomas, Paul Levy was talking about that it says that you must bring from within you, you know, something to the surface. He was actually referring to a quote, and I'll read it, from the Gospel of Thomas, in which Jesus says, if you have gained this within you, what you have within you will save you. If you do not bring from within you what you have, it will kill you. You know, and then in the Gospel of Philip, there's a quote from the Christ saying that the ignorance is the mother of all evil. So in the countdown to 2012, you know, that's what we're looking at here, is the removal of ignorance, the finding out of all of the different ways in which psychic energy and physical energy connect, how consciousness itself affects the world we live in.
Hmm. Ah, very interesting. Yeah, and this, of course, this ties into all of this, again, going back to the show with Paul Levy, but you, to move on, I mean, you talk about the connection here between children and nature also. Also, you refer to this many times. We've been talking earlier, and this is this something you want to talk more about?
Well, see, children are closer than nature because they're earliest born. An adult, by moving away from the spirit, by getting older, in a way, he's getting further and further away from the place of spirit.
Mm.
And remember, the parent is always full of anxiety. He's transmitting or projecting his anxiety complexes onto the child. So the child, you know, we say, how is it that people grow up to live with great paradoxes? Here they are, you know, knowing that it's wrong to kill and it's wrong to murder, and yet they're voting for, you know, the Iraqi war.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, yeah, everyone knows and everyone can see that human adults live in a tremendous sense of division and paradoxes. They believe one thing and then go and do another. That kind of syndrome is implanted in the child because of the child's identification with the parents.
Do you think
the child has to often be ambivalent within the family circle? It has to identify with one character or the other, or both, because the child, of course, does not want to hurt either one of the parents, and it doesn't want to shame the parent by saying, "Oh, I favor one over the other."
Mm-hmm.
So the child is automatically created an ambiguous situation. So the child, from a very early age, learns to live with paradox.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, a child can grow up and say, "Hey, I believe that nobody should kill, but I don't care if all those, you know, people are murdered over there by our troops, our way of life." So again, you know, it's in the family dynamic.
Do you think
you find a lot of this kind of stuff going on?
Sure.
But children are basically—it's very connected to the mystery of nature, because, you know, nature doesn't have thought. Nature does not think, and when the child is young in the pre-rational state, it isn't thinking either. But yet it's getting its wisdom, isn't it?
Yeah, sure.
Right, so the reason is the highest form of intelligence or faculty that the mind or the brain can develop. And we always want to develop reason. But we never say that reason is the only form of gaining knowledge. You know, there's other ways, Socratic ways or whatever,
mm-hmm.
of receiving your wisdom through the right brain, through the intuition, through the imagination. And children are very connected to this. And this is when nature, the real nature, is speaking to you.
Hmm.
And nature is, nature's way of teaching is very great. And children can be close to that. Children are sort of a teacher to us of that particular voice of nature, which most adults have learned to completely, you know, not listen to.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually personally believe, you see, that personally, very much a personal statement here, but I believe that nature and animal is actually a higher form of consciousness than human beings.
Hmm, interesting.
Oh, yeah. I look at it like, well, imagine it, that human trees, plants, you know, cactus,
mm-hmm.
animals. I mean, you only have to look in the eyes of an elephant. Go and look at the face of an elephant.
Hmm.
You know, and tell me that that's not one of the most intelligent, wise animals you've ever seen. You know, a single killer whale, in one conversation, because they've been able to record the conversation, the tones
mm-hmm.
of killer whales,
mm-hmm.
and they found out that a single conversation of a killer whale contains 15 million pieces of information,
mm-hmm.
while the average human, or say even a passage in the Bible, contains 4 pieces of information.
Hmm.
The same amount.
Interesting.
So we're dealing with something far beyond. It's almost like the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom has said, we don't want thought, we're moving beyond it.
That
you know, imagine that the universe out there has chosen not to think because thinking is so pathetic.
Hmm.
Remember that interior life we talked about the ego sort of being an aberration in a way?
Yeah, sure.
Well, this goes to the heart of the outsider. The outsider thinks of them in the beginning, and if you get on my blog, you'll see so many people, you know, trying to understand this concept of why they feel so different in society.
Mm-hmm.
The outsider's problem is that, and children are outsiders. Every child that you see basically is an outsider until they're being dragged, you know, head, and they're being dragged by their feet into this world of the lie until they're forced to conform.
Mm-hmm.
But the outsider is a being that basically thinks of himself as an aberration until he finds out the root of his dilemmas.
Hmm.
you know, until he discovers that, look, seeing the city as being a ludicrous way to live, living in cities, which was only meant for a very small amount of people, but now, you know, millions are living in these places.
Yeah.
And seeing that all the things that man is building and doing and creating, I mean, it's not animals that are going around polluting. It's not animals that are seeking out man to destroy them. If you compare, you don't have to be Schopenhauer, you know, or to discover that if you compare the deeds of men to animals and animals to men, which one looks the most demonic of the species? I mean, plain and simple, right?
Yeah, sure.
So animals, to me, are a higher form of being because, you know, if you even compare the simple behavior, you'll notice that there's something off. But the outsider realizes that, look, I get to the point when I'm brilliant at critiquing other people and the world and the cities and all the kind of stupidity that human beings get into, but where do I go from there? If you remain just a critic, then you're caught in this depression and the dilemma.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The message of the outsider is to get actively involved with their own dharma, you know, and also get involved with nature and go back to something that is more pristine, that is not all of the human smudge. Because if you continue to, you know, put your energies into the human drama solely, you will definitely, you know, end up in a very great state of angst. Therefore, there's a divorce that is needed. I talked about this in the Future of Mankind web stream, that there's a divorce, a sort of a chemical divorce that needs to come before one inherits the chemical wedding. There's a, you know, to get out of that despair that often follows the outsider around, there's a need to refresh and realize that they're not crazy. You see the craziness, but there's also an alternative to that craziness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have the inner work to do.
Sure, sure. I mean, I just wanted to comment on what you said about animals being kind of more intelligent in a way than humans. I think that that's a very interesting thought. And one thing that just came to mind here was, couldn't it also be that, you know, that animals and plants and so forth are, you know, very much closer to the source. They're closer to the, in quotes here, kingdom of God, so to speak. They're operating closer to that, and we as the man or human, as the kind of the rebel, the outspurts, have kind of you know, went into the way of becoming self-aware, I guess. Do you think that animals are self-aware in the same way that human beings are?
No, they don't possess. I believe they have selves. I believe that and each animal has an individuality. I mean, it's obvious. Anybody who's got an animal or keeps a dog or has horses know that they have individuality. Well, then that is the same thing as a self. But they don't operate with a limited self-narcissistic, meaning animals do not possess an idea of themselves. And they don't possess an idea of us. We are the ones who manufacture this internal aberration, which is the idea of things. You know,
sure.
The Democritus, the great Greek philosopher, and I mean, he basically quantum scientists looked to him as one of their heroes because of what he was talking about when he came to the atom. And he also spoke a lot on the intelligence of nature. He spoke of a thing called the spiritus incertus atomis. And he said that is the spirit that moves within the atoms. You know, a glowworm can produce its own light without heat.
Yeah.
Human being cannot produce light without heat.
Nope.
You know, the bumblebee flies, breaking all the laws of aerodynamics. Spiders, you know, produce thread that is far stronger than their own bodies.
Yeah.
Ants can lift weight that's hundreds of times, you know, more than their own weight.
Sure.
The elephant alone is, the king of all animals. Was considered by the Vedics to be this one of the supreme gods of their pantheon is Ganesha, you know, based on the animal deity, because of its memory and its qualities, and it's just what people can learn from being in the presence of animals. I can give you in writing that if you spend your time with animals and you spend a year, you know, take a man just like Grizzly, you know, the Herzog movie. Yeah, he made a movie about the man who was close to the grizzly bears, and instead of coming back to society after being with those bears, he basically committed suicide. Well, I tell anyone out there, you go and spend 1 year in the company of the various kinds of animals in some capacity, and then you spend another year in the company of human beings, and you come back and tell me from which you learned the most.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be Robinson Crusoe to do it. It's a fact that animals, through their presence, and children as well, this is very, very important. To realize that there's a reason why the Egyptian gods have animal heads, you know? I mean, there's absolutely a reason for that.
Yeah.
And if, you know, these ancient philosophers have seen the mystery that moves in nature, and they've understood the power of that, and that living within the circumference of the ego you know, is a very, very dastardly thing that can bring about all sorts of insanity,
mm-hmm.
bring about all sorts of pain and dilemmas. So there's a tremendous need in the future here to, you know, sort of observe what this ecocide that the ego breeds. The ego is tremendously threatened by the wisdom of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it wants to destroy nature as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But the children of the world are the barometer of who we are psychically. So when anybody is seeing this aberrations in the children, they better realize those changes, the character, the behavior, those are barometers of what man is happening within his own psyche. And now we have a whole cult of doctors and specialists and experts out there who are moving very, very far away and are very happy to see dysfunctional, emotionally, you know, hung up children in their schools so that they can prescribe drugs for those, so that they can remove them, so that they can create a whole new generation, you know, of zombies and mooks and total...
mooks, yes. Yeah.
You know, demographics for them to work on. And remember, they've looked back and found that the previous generations, there has been a lot of rebellion from the working class and from the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
They're hoping to have a future, you know, where there's no rebellion, but there's complete and utter conformity. And they'll get it the way things are going.
Yeah, absolutely. This brings up so many points. I mean, again, I think this only says that our surrounding is, in that sense, perfect. It is, as you say, it is the spirit within the atoms, you know, and our, I guess, job or so to speak is to kind of observe this and to learn, I guess, from nature and to, you know, pick up on the things that science are beginning to do now, like we find the Fibonacci spiral in everything. That's a holographic repetition in all we see. It's a perfect mesh kind of reality we live in, and we can learn from being able to pick up on that. But what we're doing now, I guess, instead then, is to actually destroying the planet around us. We're destroying nature, and we're, you know, going against the climate. And I guess this again is a is a reflection of our psyche.
Exactly. And you see, what we're doing also is we're thinking that we're destroying nature. Actually, that's another aberration, because you see, nature cannot be destroyed. Do you remember we were talking about the leaders and how evil they are,
mm-hmm.
and that they've lost their sense of humanity? What we also don't understand is that in doing that, in sacrificing your humanity as a human being, by becoming less of a moral creature, by doing things that breach humanity and morality, you're actually becoming less and less of a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in doing that, you actually set yourself up against the natural order. So I keep telling people, you know, coming to me going, what are we going to do, and what kind of action can we take against these guys? You know, first of all, don't realize that these people are setting themselves up as targets, because nature will not tolerate an aberration like that.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so in a way, you don't have to do, it's like the Lord of the Rings movie shows, you really don't have to do that much to bring the evil down, because evil, by being evil, brings the wrath of nature upon it.
Mm-hmm.
People can study this as a science, they can see it. That the more you lose your natural quality, meaning in Jungian terms, they would say that the more and more you move away from your natural instincts. So when people are saying that these evil men are animalistic, you see, and they're moving from their appetites and they're moving from their animal nature, I find that a repulsive statement.
Hmm.
It's because they're not moving from their animal nature.
Yeah.
That they're doing this. They're moving from the nature of the city. Hmm. They're moving from the nature of the artificial.
Hmm.
They're moving from the nature of the phallic skyscraper, the ithy-phallic religions, right?
Yeah.
And the whole Apollonian type of science that they've been brought up into, and a lot of this Darwinian, you know, Bertrand Russell, Fabian, anti-human, super-intellectual BS that they've been brought up. It's because they're disconnected from their instincts and animal nature that they're able to act in such an inhuman way. A man who is close to his animal nature does not, in fact, do these kinds of things. That's another twist, you know, that has been misunderstood.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think that, like, the rising crime in society is connected, you know, to the conflict between the ego and self?
Like you said last time, and you asked a question about that, you know, see, the rising crime is based on impotency. Man, because he has no true sense of capacity, from a child, he's robbed of any kind of meaning, or he's so super saturated with all these expectations that the parents want, and overstimulated. Well, you know, first of all, we open children to all the stimulation of the world, and then tell them, sit down, shut up, don't speak up.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to then decompress from all the super stimulation that they've got, So then you have what we would call a bored teenager, an apathetic teenager who's depressed.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's depressed. His circuits are completely burned out with 14 or more years of all the crap that the world has fed him.
Sure, yeah.
And then when he wanted to act on any of it or get inspired by any of it, you basically curtail that. So that kind of teen, you see, is very much likely then to feel so impotent that he will take to knives and guns, you see, and bombs and crime, and he'll identify with criminals. Not that these people are worth identifying with, but, you know, to the eyes of a demented teenager who's totally never been empowered by anything, you know, the Hillside Strangler can seem like a really great guy. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. I mean, this is what happens.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean,
what's worse, right? The Hillside Strangler and those kinds of people, or David Berkowitz, you know, whoever, or the people who are going out in the army to mass murder, to kick down doors and mutilate and bomb and torture, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And hideously torture people in cells because, you know, they happen to be fighting for their own country or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, tell me which one is really, you know, the worst situation here. So, again, we send a hypocritical mixed message to the children.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, there's a quote from Jung. He said that, I have to read this, it's an excellent quote, if we have time. He said,
sure.
If things go wrong in the world, this is because something is wrong with the individual, because something is wrong with me. Therefore, if I am sensible, I shall put myself right first. For this I need, because I need no outside authority. Right? Outside authority, he says, no longer means anything to me, so I need a knowledge of the innermost foundations of my being in order that I may base myself firmly on the eternal facts of the human psyche. But as I said, the ego is like a carnival. It creates this super drama so it can troubleshoot and troubleshoot and troubleshoot all this manufactured chaos in our daily life so that we're so burned out psychically from that, and we're so burned out physically from working and from, you know, trying to gain the approval of other idiots.
Yeah, yeah.
So we burn our circuits out that you don't have any reflective quality anymore, because it does take a certain amount of homework, you see.
Yeah.
It takes you to, you know, have time and space and peace and quiet.
Sure.
In order to be examined yourself. I mean, actually, you can do it anywhere. But ultimately, the idea is to do it patiently and lovingly and be observe yourself without shame and without blame.
Yeah.
Well, that takes a certain kind of energy. And the mind knows that the more chaos it can manufacture for you to troubleshoot, the less likely you're going to have the energy to, you know, you'll be so maxed out there that your life will be just a completely super extroverted type of carnival in which you won't even possess the time to sit down and really examine yourself.
Again, can we connect this with a fact that so many people in the recent years have been, as they say, burned out, that they're, you know, that actually come to a point where they collapse and can't continue, and this will finally get them in the position where they can hopefully, in a calm way, actually begin to learn this that you're talking about.
Right, and that brings, I think so, because remember Paul was also talking about, what was he talking about? He was saying it's the saturation point.
Yeah.
When you add salt or sugar, you know, you keep adding it and keep adding it and keep adding it. Or some people call it the critical mass.
Sure.
I think so. I think that we, not just the leaders, who are working with a very dark form of sorcery, but basically every human being in the world is coming to the point where they're going to have to face their inner self. Because if you don't do it by will, and you don't do it by choice, you're still going to have to do it. Nature leaves you no alternative. There are these underworld cycles. These underworld cycles, they go for civilizations. All civilizations have to go through them, and all people have to go through them. We know that the ego, or at least I feel that the ego itself, the collective ego, was already in such a disordered state that it basically created psychoanalysis. I believe that the coming of psychoanalysis, or if the, you know, the idea of a man, Freud, or anyone else, coming up with a subject in which the psyche could analyze itself, is already a kind of a meta signal that, you know, the ego needed to tidy up itself. And so it became a little bit more unconcealed. Because first, you know, man didn't even analyze himself, except very, very, very few people in the world. So I believe that the dawning of the age of psychoanalysis was sort of permitted by the world ego, or the mind, in order so that it could sort of troubleshoot itself, because it was just in such a schizoid state. This is what I believe.
Ah, interesting.
So even from the time of 1930, I see that we're already counting down to a time in which we could be ending, you know, a cycle of the ego. And I believe that this is connected to 2012, the Maya date.
Sure.
I certainly do believe it's connected to the end of the age of Pisces, because the return of the whole zodiac processionally to the end of the age of Pisces is very much a sign of the waning of the ego power. and a lot of the chaos that we're seeing around us is part of this. But this critical mass or this saturation point is people just living in such an inauthentic way, set themselves up to be, to, you know, have a response from nature, mm-hmm. where there's some sort of magic comes in to face the sorcery, basically. That man can only get so bad. And we can also look at this geomantically. I've talked about this in the DVDs, in which the simply the physical or psychic energy builds up in the human psyche in the limbic realm and then passes into the earth grid. The earth grid is nothing more than an extension, or it's partly an extension of human psyche. And it's getting so dark and black, you know, and toxic right now, mm-hmm. that can also cause what we might respond as earth changes.
Hmm.
So that the so-called earth changes mm-hmm. are precipitated by human consciousness. It's another important element what people got to realize, because otherwise, again, they're going to be pointing to that as an escape. Just, oh, look, act of God, you know, freak of nature.
Sure.
And something came about to... But I would say that even political events, certainly even climatical events, nothing is disconnected from consciousness, nothing. And in fact, I go so far to say, you know, just like Wilhelm Reich had done, that most of what happens externally is called into being by the unconscious mind.
Hmm.
Because psychic energy of an archetypal nature is absolutely articulated to, you know, the matrix outside of ourselves. It's just the ego has kind of hidden that fact. It sort of obscures this truth, like with blinkers on the mind, but it's actually a fact. So the changes in the earth grid, changes in the habitat, changes in the behavior of animals, and also, you know, in the dynamics that people are having in their relationships, are dramatically going to change because of this plutonic energy coming in.
Ah, yeah.
And as people go, you know, experience this underworld journey.
Yeah. It's an exciting time, and it's a time where we can learn a lot, I guess, and to kind of finally, hopefully, awaken to at least many of these topics as we've been talking about today. I mean, are you positive in regards to the future?
Well, I'm positive, I'm positive about it, but I also have to remember, you know, because I deal so much with the public, that I have to keep counseling people who don't feel positive.
Mm-hmm.
And they look at what's happening, you know, and they see so much immorality and treachery from people and so much undercutting. And, you know, then they try helpfully to talk about these kinds of conspiratorial or alternative history subjects, and they get put down and snubbed.
Sure.
So I'm constantly reminding people to, you know, beware of that, you know, you're dealing with people of the lie. And another thing I'd like to say is pretty radical, but a lot of people who, when they're born, you know, especially those who've chosen an inauthentic life, like we were talking about in the beginning of this series of shows about the inauthentic life and the tree of guilt, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Those people who've chosen the inauthentic life, Henrik, you know, there's a taboo against killing yourself physically, like suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what human beings do when they realize that they're committed, and I mean absolutely committed, to a life of total extroversion, sensationality, mediocrity, going to work, you know, just a 9-to-5, there's a lot of people who know that they don't have the energy to make those changes. And they know they don't have the energy to be moral or virtuous people.
Hmm.
But they, at the same time, cannot, you know, kill themselves, because there's actually sort of a taboo in another part of the ego against that.
Mm, yeah, sure.
So what you see when you look around the world is people committing slow suicide.
Hmm.
So slowly that they're not even aware of it consciously themselves.
Hmm.
So don't be frustrated tomorrow when you're trying to talk to a group of people, you see, or some friends, and they're not listening to what you're saying. My God, you people need to wake up and realize this is a person who's already dying.
Yeah.
Spiritually, psychically, emotionally. He may have already murdered his own emotions.
Huh.
This person, either through alcohol or through just endless immersion into the world's, you know, situation, or through immoral deeds or self-sadism, you know, there's a whole cocktail of different ways you can do it.
Mm, yeah.
But mentally, it's a mental idea that people stretch out their death over 20, 30 years, and it's done so gradually they're not even really aware they're doing it.
Huh.
So by the time you're meeting somebody at 30, 29, you know, 35 years of age, you might be talking to somebody who's already partly, you know, psychically a corpse. And then you're wondering why this person isn't getting your light and getting the fact that, you know, you're talking about some very spiritual, you know, illustrious and very, very lofty kind of ideas. Well, I'll tell you the reason.
You know,
I look around and I see, remember we were talking one time about Thanatos instinct, the death instinct?
Yeah.
And this is connected to the Shiva energy, and it's connected to Pluto, and that we see it in people all the time, and it's one of these instincts. When you see this fast pace of life, a lot of people critique the fast pace of life, and people just running about, you know, frenetically all over the world, just busy with all the rubbish of the world.
Mm.
You know, one way of looking at all haste is that this is part of the slow suicide thing. People are anxious to hurry as fast as they can to the grave.
That's true, yeah. I mean,
think about it for a minute.
Yeah.
What on earth would all this rushing about be if you step back and look at it? You say, well, of course they're rushing around like that in the sensual world, because one, the rushing around helps you to forget, you know, that you have a soul and that you have any meaning or purpose.
Mm, yeah.
And the second thing is you're rushing like a mad one because you're so sick of your mediocrity that you're so itching for death. This is the Thanatos instinct.
Mm.
You're so itching for annihilation that you and the rest of society is moving at breakneck speed in order to really get to that point of annihilation subliminally. There's such a subliminal death instinct in you. Now, I bet you this is confirmed by a lot of analysis.
Oh,
people
yeah.
on Madison Avenue certainly know it because you only have to watch their rock videos, rap videos,
yeah.
and commercials to see that they play on the death instinct enormously.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, all
yeah.
the different commercials and heroin chic
yeah.
and all sorts of rubbish that they're into is showing you this death instinct at work, or the super denial of it, you know, because it's in two different ways. It's like, oh, no, I'm not of that. I'm of the super solar shining, you know, sunny side of the street
yeah, yeah.
mentality. You know, but again, that's based on the death instinct. So we have people here, you know, who can save themselves a lot of trauma, the protagonists. When you see antagonists, the mask slipping down and people acting in a bizarre way, realize that, look, wait a minute, you know, you should be carving the headstone here because these people are not real, they're not sane, and they're not even fully alive. So don't waste your time on them.
Mm. I think that's a powerful, very powerful tip, basically, that we can take from that.
It's slow suicide. Check
yeah.
it out. Study it.
Absolutely.
Find out, you know, observe people in a certain way and you'll see them doing it.
Mm.
You'll see, if you're really keen, because I'm not just shooting the breeze here, I absolutely mean this fundamentally.
Yeah, yeah.
Most people you meet are committing slow suicide.
Mm.
It's a well-known psychological, you know, complex.
Sure.
So observe these people in this necrotic stuff that they're doing, and their ideas, excuse me.
Mm, no problem.
In their mentality, and in some of the things that they do.
Yeah, I totally agree. The addiction, you can
yeah.
see it in traffic, the speed maniacs and all of this stuff. I totally agree.
Yeah.
Michael, I think we should end this segment. We're gone a few minutes over here, but I didn't want to stop because we're on such a good track here. So, but anyway, I'm looking forward to very, very much speaking with you again next month, of course, continuing in the regular show. We have a few subscribers interviews with Michael, and we've got a few coming up. Again, his website is michaeltesarion.com, and you have to check out his DVD series, originsandoracles.com, and get yourself one of those because they are absolutely excellent. So, again, Michael, anything you want to finish off with? Mention your blog again so people can find it.
If they go to michaeltesarion.com, they'll be able to get through to the blog, no problem.
Mm, okay, excellent.
Now, I just want to say, go and watch the Aaron Rousseau interview with Alex Jones. It's a very, very interesting interview, and there's a lot of great stuff on the blog. It's updated all the time.
Excellent. Okay, so until next time, thank you very much, Michael. We'll talk again.
Brilliant, Hendrik. Thank you.
Upcoming soon, we have a kind of continuation on this theme of children and teenagers. For our subscribers, we are going to talk with Michael about the subversive use of sacred symbolism in the media, and connect this with Douglas Rushkoff's PBS documentary entitled The Merchants of Cool, and I recently linked up this over at redicecreations.com. So heads up on this interview with Michael coming up very soon. And we have a couple of subscriber interviews available with Michael Tesarion, and if you're interested in tuning into those and get full access to our archive and at the same time support the website and this radio show, do click on subscribe or sign up and read more about it. We have in the past couple of days made improvements to the sign-up process and made things a little easier. And now you can also choose if you want to pay with either US dollars or euros. And we have made a few other improvements also. So do check it out if you're interested. Thank you so much for listening to the program, and thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren behind the controls for taking care of the audio. We will be back this Sunday with another show for you. In the meantime, we'll see each other on redicecreations.com. This is Henrik Palmgren. Take care. We'll talk soon.